possible. He used working agreements with promotions in Japan and Mexico to bring in talented performers from around the world and expose them to a new audience. The show basically had it all. Big names, great talent, and good matches. If you wanted to see established superstars like Hulk Hogan and Sting, you could watch Nitro. If you wanted to see great wrestling matches with mat technicians like Dean Malenko and Chris Benoit, you could watch Nitro. If you wanted to see crazy high spots from Mexican luchadores, you could watch Nitro. It was the best of all worlds, and the company caught fire. Things were clearly reaching a peak in early 1998. However, for every dollar made, it was as though WCW made another huge mistake. And for every million they made one huge mistake that would help cost them everything in the end. The biggest mistake of all was that nothing changed. Ever. At first, that doesn't sound so bad. They made more money in 1 year than the money they'd lost in all the previous years put together. Why change anything? The answer, of course, is that nothing is forever. Those big stars, some of them were old. Plus, those who were old in 1995 were now 3 years older. Some couldn't wrestle a good match to save their lives, and some, sadly, could barely even move. The nostalgia was gone, and now that all of the big, marquee matches had been used up, fans were anxious for something new. That something new, you'd think, would come from the guys on the undercard who were having all those great matches 3 years earlier. The good news is that those guys were still having great matches. The bad news is that they were having the same great matches with the same guys that were wrestling in 1995. As great a match as Rey Mysterio versus Juventud Guerrera was, fans could only see Rey give him a Hurricanrana so many times. In essence, Nitro looked the same in 1998 as it did in 1995. When you have several hours of first-run television every single week, 3 years might as well be 3 decades. And anyone who follows the television industry knows that no weekly television program featuring the same characters, no matter how hot it is at its peak, lasts forever. And make no mistake about it, there was plenty of talent that just never got a chance, and it was taking its toll. Conan said, "I don't think you ever heard anyone say they liked WCW, even the guys making millions of dollars. Even though we were all being paid a lot of money to shut up, we were all being held back. There were drugs everywhere. I never had to use drugs before I got to WCW. Never even thought I would use them. And I thought anyone who did use them was a loser. Everybody was pissed off. Everyone was depressed." Chris Jericho said, "The social aspects of WCW were disheartening. Hogan and Savage had their own dressing rooms and didn't really talk to anyone else. Guys like Scott Steiner, DDP, Paul White, and Booker T later became my friends, but within the WCW environment, they seemed uptight and defensive. Booker even balked at working with Dean, Eddie, and me, complaining, 'I ain't no cruiserweight,' as if he would get leprosy from touching us." In early January, two major television changes took place, both ultimately for the worse. First, after internal pressure from TBS, WCW created a new 2-hour program to air every Thursday night, Thunder. Originally, it was going to be an NWO show, but that idea went out the window when NWO Nitro bombed. Bischoff was vehemently against the idea, realizing that not only would it likely oversaturate the market, which it eventually did, though not at first, but it would also possibly take a chunk out of Nitro's numbers. The estimated $12 million that TBS paid the company for the show helped to change his mind. The downside to the addition of Thunder from the boys' perspective was that, all of a sudden, they had 52 more dates on their schedule for the year. One of the perks of working for WCW back in the day was that you could make better money than in the WWF and work fewer dates. Now, with another TV program and more house show dates, the road schedule was getting harder, and the guaranteed deals meant that the wrestlers were pretty much doing those extra dates for free. This didn't exactly go over too well. Amazingly, no one in charge of WCW had any idea whether the debut episode was going to be 2 hours or 3 until just a few days prior. It ended up going 3 hours and 15 minutes, which threw the rest of the TBS schedule into disarray. Although it was more of a laid-back show, compared by some to WCW Saturday Night, It ended up drawing what was alleged to be the highest debut cumulative rating in cable TV history, a 4.0. To give you an idea of how hot WCW was at the time, the January 15 Thunder drew a 3.7 rating, despite the fact that a satellite malfunction destroyed the picture quality and caused the entire show to be virtually unwatchable, as opposed to years later when the show was unwatchable regardless of whether the picture was good or not. The second major change took place on January 26th, as Nitro was also overhauled and given an additional hour, making it a 3-hour program. If 4 hours of WCW Weekly weren't enough, fans were now given 5. Over at Raw, the WWF was building towards WrestleMania 14, and appearing in some capacity on television most weeks was the man who would be the guest enforcer in the Shawn Michaels versus Steve Austin WWF title match, Mike Tyson. As a result, once Nitro ended, many viewers were jumping over to Raw. Instead of moving the 2 hours head-to-head, Nitro was airing from 8 to 10 and Raw from 9 to 11, the decision was made to have Nitro go an extra hour permanently. It experimented with a few 3-hour shows in late 1997, therefore keeping the high, unopposed first-hour rating to add to their cumulative total. Alongside all the additional television time, the year started out with yet another new record. 26,733 fans and a $510,610 gate for a January 5 show at the Georgia Dome. It was highlighted by a classic interview between Bret Hart and Ric Flair, in which Hart said that if Flair, who was still the top ratings draw in either company, had a problem with him calling himself the best there is, was, and ever will be, he could do something about it. Some thought it was too early to be booking this match, but the crowd was clearly clamoring to see it. Hart versus Flair took place at the first pay-per-view of the year, sold out. The event, largely considered a success, drew a sellout 5,087 fans to Dayton's Hera Arena to witness Luger beat Savage in a horrible main event. Worse yet, they had a chance to have a great headliner with Hart versus Flair, but at the last minute the match was moved up to the semi-main position. The reason Luger and Savage went on last was that Hulk Hogan did a run-in afterwards, and of course, he couldn't do a run-in on a semi-main. The buy rate for the show ended up being on par with many of the Hogan headline shows, largely due to the hype for what ended up being an excellent Flair versus Hart match. And how did WCW reward these two men for having such a great match, drawing such great ratings, and popping such a great buy rate? They ended the feud cold turkey and took Flair off TV for several weeks. The reasoning was that too many people were cheering for Flair, and they wanted him to be a bad guy. If the people couldn't play along and boo him, then they would be punished with his absence. Ironically, later in the year, when Bret was getting a strong babyface reaction, despite being booked as a heel, he too was removed from television. Yet another lesson not learned. In addition to the horrific main event, there was almost another disaster at the pay-per-view as Giant landed on his head after Nash attempted to give him a powerbomb. The two had done the spot successfully in February 1997, but a year later Nash was physically weaker, having suffered a knee injury. Giant had put on what looked to be about 100 pounds through various means, most of which involved consuming massive amounts of pizza and milk. Nash got him about halfway up, then dropped him right on his neck. Thankfully, Giant was okay. WCW Commissioner J.J. Dillon later announced in Storyline that because of the incident, the powerbomb was now banned. Of course, the ban affected everyone in the company except Nash, who used it regularly and began to get over as a rebellious babyface because of it. At first, he would be, quote, fined $150,000 and, quote, arrested every time he did it. But eventually the bookers completely forgot about it and the angle was dropped. Hogan was all over TV. Some found this strange since he allegedly was not under contract at the time. The belief of many backstage was that this was the latest political move by arguably the most brilliant strategist in wrestling history. Hogan, making around $5 million per year, knew WWF wouldn't offer him anything close to that, especially since they were already investing millions in Tyson for WrestleMania. So using the creative control written into his contract, he booked himself on TV until he was pretty much indispensable, then started to float rumors around that he was about to jump ship to the opposition. It worked. And not only did he get re-signed for his $5 million, but he got a $1.5 million bonus as well. Some would argue that, from a business perspective, WCW would have been foolish not to re-sign him. As an untelevised January 31 house show that he worked against Sting drew 18,759 fans and $325,154 at the gate, a new company record. As if anyone needed a sign of just how hot the company was at the time, Sin City Productions began work early in the year on a porn video called Nude World Order. Porn industry takes note. You can be sure you're onto something. Not only was the company doing incredible numbers at the box office, but the ratings continued to soar as well. In fact, the ratings war seemed more futile than ever for the WWF as the February 2nd Nitro, headlined by Hogan versus Savage for the 9 millionth time, did its second highest rating in history, a 4.93 to Raw's 3.45. This was the most impressive number of all time up to this point, because the previous record, a 4.97, on August 25, 1997, was set on a week in which Raw had been preempted for tennis, giving Nitro full access to the entire wrestling audience. Speaking of impressive numbers, Hogan did an interview on the show that showed great attention to detail, as he talked about the $50,000 fines Nash would be paying for executing the powerbomb. The announcers never bothered to note the $100,000 discrepancy in his tale. It didn't help that a few days earlier on Thunder, J.J. Dillon had added to the confusion by talking about the $5,000 fines that were being levied. It was just the latest in a string of storyline inconsistencies that would soon become WCW's trademark. In the midst of all of these incredible numbers, tragedy struck. On February 14, Louis Spicoli, who had just turned 27 and was starting to get a push in WCW as a Chris Farley-like NWO lackey, died of a drug overdose. Spicoli, who took as many as 30 Soma pain pills daily, had washed down 27 with some alcohol. He was found dead in his home at 8:55 a.m., face down in his own vomit. It wasn't his first overdose. In fact, in 1996, while working for the WWF, he'd collapsed after taking 55 Somas and was in critical condition for 2 days. Disturbingly, he told friends just days before his death that he was concerned that the drug use in the company was getting out of control. The following Monday, Nitro opened with a tribute for him. His close friends on the show weren't allowed to mention him at all. The only person who did bring him up was Larry Zbyszko, with whom he'd been feuding. Zbyszko said that there were a few things he'd like to say, but out of respect for the family, he'd keep his mouth shut. Yes, a guy really died, but because there was a wrestling war to fight, WCW wouldn't even allow Zbyszko to get out of character to acknowledge it. Backstage, there was some shock and sadness, but overall, it was business as usual. In fact, to show just how brazen some wrestlers in WCW were, Dr. Joel Hackett, who had prescribed the pills to Spicoli, was flown into San Francisco for that weekend Super Brawl pay-per-view. Before 12,620 fans at the Cow Palace, the Super Brawl pay-per-view was yet another sellout, with yet another subpar main event. Sting beat Hogan to win the held-up WCW title, but he'd been killed so dead by the Starrcade booking that it was way too little, way too late. Worse, he couldn't even make it a clean win, as Randy Savage had to hit Hogan with a spray paint can prior to the finish. Once again, Sting came out looking far inferior to the almighty Hulkster, and fans were starting to catch on to that fact. If that wasn't bad enough, the usually great undercard wasn't so great, although DDP versus Benoit and Chris Jericho versus Juventud Guerrera were both very good. The latter match was the subject of a lot of controversy. Guerrera, real name Anibal Gonzalez, was the son of famous Mexican wrestler Fuerza Guerrera. In Mexico, the pro wrestler's mask, a symbolic takeoff on the masks worn hundreds of years earlier in Aztec rituals, is considered almost sacred, and to lose it is normally a very big deal. The biggest superstar in the history of the culture, El Santo, never unmasked after he took on that persona, and he was even buried with it on. Because of the long tradition, which started when Salvador Luderoth's family opened up the Empresa Mexicana de Lucha Libre promotion in 1933, major mask versus mask or mask versus hair matches continue to sell out huge buildings such as Arena Mexico. WCW, however, didn't care about all that tradition stuff. After all, this was the United States of America, where wrestlers did not hide their faces. Guerrera, Bischoff explained again, just wasn't marketable with the mask on. When Guerrero was first approached about losing his mask, he, along with his father and all the other luchadores, was appalled by the suggestion. Bischoff swore that they would make a huge deal out of it, building it up over a long period of time with a series of major angles to make the match really mean something. The big push ended up with a loss to mid-carder Billy Kidman, a win over low mid-carder El Dandy, a loss to Jericho at Super Brawl, and ultimately, the sale at the merchandise stand of his and Mysterio's masks a year later. It wasn't like the luchadores were the only upset mid-carders. Eddie Guerrero, frustrated with both the mask situation and what he saw as a complete lack of upward mobility, tried to quit. Bischoff not only told him no, but yelled at him for even considering it. Later, Eric apologized. He was not sorry enough, however, to give Eddie his release. Dean Malenko wanted to know when Bischoff was going to keep his word and let him book a cruiserweight tournament. Bischoff, tactful boss that he was, replied that Malenko, Guerrero, Hoovy, Mysterio, Benoit and the like were all great workers, but none of them put asses in the seats. Their unhappiness was of no concern to Bischoff, who on the morning of February 17 was overjoyed to learn that the previous evening's Nitro, which ran unopposed as the Westminster Dog Show preempted Raw, had done a 5.10 rating, yet another brand new record. Better yet, it was widely considered to have been a great show, despite the fact that the booking was headache-inducing, and Hogan's old buddy Ed Leslie, now known as E. Harrison Leslie, was introduced as the newest NWO member, further watering down the once elite faction. Not only was Nitro again breaking its own records, but Eric also had a great card in mind for the uncensored pay-per-view on March 15th in Mobile, Alabama. Hogan versus Savage in a cage. Sting versus Scott Hall for the WCW title. Luger versus Scott Steiner. And the Giant versus Nash. Sure, it was the same old, largely horrible workers on top, but it didn't matter. It was considered a top-billing marquee. The same day that Nitro set this record, Randy Savage was named Real Man of the Year by the Harvard Lampoon for exuding, quote, universal manliness. Welcome to 1998. The next week, Raw and Nitro drew a combined 8.60 rating for shows that saw, on one side, the baddest man on the planet, Mike Tyson, joined the cutting-edge Shawn Michaels-led D-Generation X faction. And on the other side, the 100-zillionth NWO run-in DQ. Fans were anxious for WCW to do something dramatically different and creative, like, say, a clean finish. But WCW saw no reason to do that. After all, their show did a 4.81, and Vince's show only did a 3.80. They beat the WWF by a full point. There was no reason to change anything. Backstage, things continued to spiral out of control. The luchadores suddenly informed that they would no longer be able to take bookings in Mexico on their off days, were more upset than ever. Most had been making good money collecting paychecks from both WCW and independent groups south of the border. Once the decree was made, some ignored it and took bookings anyway, while others began to trade ideas on ways to get fired. The company's deal with New Japan Pro Wrestling also fell apart. For years, the two sides had been trading talent back and forth. Usually, it was to WCW's advantage. New Japan would send over one of their big superstars like Masahiro Chono, while WCW would send over talent like Robbie Rage, who was unknown not only in Japan, but also in the U.S. Obviously, the international talent spiced up WCW television, and in fact, Keiji Muto, as the Great Muda, was one of the company's huge stars of the late 80s. The deal fell through mostly because Eric went on one of his now trademarked power trips. New Japan had an NWO stable, and Bischoff decided to enforce a contract stipulation between the two sides that enabled him to choose who could and who could not be considered a member. Keep in mind that there wasn't one casual fan in the United States who would have had any idea who was and was not in New Japan's NWO stable. The point was that Bischoff had the power, so he was going to use it. As if that wasn't bad enough, he started trying to enforce which guys could even team up with NWO guys. It also didn't help when word got out in Japan that Bischoff had gone behind New Japan's back in an attempt to strike up a deal to send wrestlers to a show run by its competition, All Japan Pro Wrestling. This was hardly Eric's only power play of the month. Back home, he was having problems with Hall and Nash, who were upset that they were being moved down the pecking order in favor of Hogan and his new best friend, Randy Savage. Bischoff decided to show them who was boss in a very brash manner. He fired, via overnight courier, their best friend in the company, Sean Waltman, a.k.a. Six. Worse, Waltman was on the shelf at the time, healing a broken neck. Amidst quite a bit of fanfare, he ended up quickly signing a deal to return to the WWF. To fans watching at home, it appeared that a big WCW star had suddenly decided that the WWF was really the place to be. To disgruntled WCW wrestlers, especially the smaller guys, it suggested that if they jumped ship, they might also get a big push right out of the gate. Waltman was given a raise of almost $100,000 more than what he had been making in WCW, and this sent the message that the WWF was willing to pay top dollar to be competitive. Hall and Nash, meanwhile, were outraged over the firing and wanted to quit. Eric reminded them that they were under contract until 2001 and couldn't appear anywhere else before then. So they stayed, but that didn't stop them from going on TV and acting unprofessionally. In one interview, Hall told fans that he was no longer allowed to say, "Hey, yo." On another occasion, he told the Giant, "That's your cue," over the house mic. He was not reprimanded, and he took a note of this fact. Later that week, Nash got into a loud argument with Hogan backstage, actually telling him to his face that he wanted his spot. Hogan said he wasn't giving it up, brother. While Bischoff was likely stressed about everything, his worries only ran so deep. Nitro did a 5.7 quarter that week for a Sting and Savage and Giant versus Hogan and Hall and Nash match, killing Raw, which did a 3.3 for a quarter built around Austin and Tyson. Better yet, the following week, the show aired unopposed again and did a 5.58 composite, destroying the previous record of 5.10. The final quarter, featuring Sting and Luger versus Hogan and Savage, also crushed the previous week's record with an enormous 6.6. Eric felt like the king of the world. At least until Uncensored, which you'll recall had that great big marquee lineup. The undercard was again below average, although Jericho versus Malenko and DDP versus Benoit versus Raven were very good. Giant versus Nash sucked. Sting versus Hall sucked. And Hogan versus Savage was an atrociously bad cage match, even by WCW standards, that included run-ins by Sting and E. Harrison Leslie, and didn't even have a finish. To the amusement of some hardcore fans, Uncensored at least lived up to its reputation of being the worst pay-per-view WCW presented each year. But the issue that was becoming clear to anyone, except those running the company, was that, in spite of the sold-out crowds, record-breaking ratings, and amazing buy rates, they were putting on bad show after bad show. WCW was so hot in 1998 that it affected world commerce. When THQ announced that they would no longer produce WCW's wildly successful video games, their stock dropped $8 per share on the NASDAQ. Amazingly, a full 25% of THQ's titles have been WCW-related. The March 23rd Nitro was notable for being the true dawn of the Bill Goldberg era, an era that should have set the company up for long-term success, since he was about to become the company's most popular wrestler. The idea, devised by announcer Mike Tenay, was incredibly simple. Goldberg did not lose, and the commentators would play up his winning streak. Not only did this ensure that his eventual first loss would mean a great deal, and it did, but unfortunately for all the wrong reasons, but it also gave fans something to keep track of, a statistic of sorts in a fake sport that really didn't have any. In fact, fans got into it to such a degree that signs featuring simply a stat, 76-0, for example, began to appear on at Nitro. The fragile egos backstage definitely took note of his increasing popularity. In addition to Goldberg, WCW also had another star tailor-made for success, ironically as a result of an in-ring tragedy. Buff Bagwell, who had been injured earlier in the year taking a top rope bulldog. The injury was so bad that when it happened, everyone broke character and rushed to his aid. Doctors later told Buff that he was just 3 inches away from the worst-case scenario, and that he had nearly died twice due to complications. After undergoing double fusion neck surgery the next day, in a near miracle, he was told that he'd probably be able to return to training within 6 months. In his return to Nitro, Bagwell came out in a wheelchair for a face-to-face meeting with the man who broke his neck, Rick Steiner. He told Rick that it was an accident and forgave him for what happened. The people cheered. The other half of the former Steiner Brothers tag team, the heel Scott, then came out and hit his brother with a chair. Bagwell stood up, apparently to make the save, but then jumped Rick and tore his shirt off to reveal, that's right, NWO. In that instant, not only was the next potentially huge babyface star flushed down the drain, but a real-life neck injury was turned into a cornball wrestling angle. What should have been a new birth for Bagwell's major league career ended up being the beginning of its end. But it was something outside the company that month that changed WCW's fortunes forever. On March 29, Steve Austin beat Shawn Michaels to win the World Wrestling Federation Championship at WrestleMania 14. Austin's rise to the title immediately affected the ratings war. The crowning of Austin would lead the WWF into their biggest glory period ever, a period that would ultimately result just 3 short years later in the end of WCW. Every wrestling promoter alive today, and whoever lives, should strongly consider the fact that no matter how great things might be at any given moment, it really can turn around that fast. And it was turning around very fast. Despite winning handily in the ratings war just weeks earlier, Nitro was barely able to edge out Raw the following evening, 4.19 to 3.79. In fact, had Nitro not taken the lead in the last half hour, Raw would have won. The WWF show was built around Sean Waltman's debut as a member of DX. In a pretty revolutionary segment, he ran down Hogan and Bischoff before he added, "And I got something else to say. Kevin Nash and Scott Hall would be standing right here with us if they weren't being held hostage by World Championship Wrestling. And that's a fact, Eric Bischoff." With that one interview, DX was pushed over the top as being more revolutionary than the now stale NWO that over the past few months had added such prestigious members as mid-carder Bryan Adams and everyone's favorite flabby geriatric Dusty Rhodes. The devaluation of the NWO with various members certainly did WCW no favors. What was once a tightly focused group, with just 3 men, had ballooned out of control. That would have been bad enough, but over the years, in both WCW and WWE, various incarnations of the group appeared. This is a likely incomplete list of all of the various groups sporting the NWO name, or some variation thereof. NWO, the Unrefined Article. Formed in 1996 with Scott Hall and Kevin Nash as its pillars, the group would begin a run of popularity and prosperity after Hollywood Hogan became the centerpiece. Most of WCW's success over the next 2 years was hinged on this ever-expanding group, whose expanse would peripherally cause the company's downfall. NWO Japan. Also known as NWO Typhoon, the group did not, in fact, feature the services of Fred Ottman. Instead, it was an offshoot group meant to take over New Japan Pro Wrestling. NJPW icons like Masahiro Chono, the Great Muda, and Hiroyoshi Tenzan populated the faction, along with American B-Team members like Buff Bagwell and Scott Norton. NWO Wolfpack. The first group to secede from the NWO, which many point to as the beginning of the end of the effectiveness of the group. The group featured the likes of Nash and Macho Man Randy Savage, being tired of Hogan's politics, this probably wasn't a stretch from reality, and introduced a red-tinted rebel version of the Order. Lex Luger and Sting would join this decidedly heroic group, whose catchy theme song by imprisoned rapper C. Murder was quite popular. NWO Hollywood. Hogan carried on as leader of the remaining NWO members who weren't quite old and undignified enough to look silly sauntering out to Deep South hip-hop, bearing their varicose veins. Hall stayed, but was often incapacitated by his own undoings. Bret Hart was another major member, though he had a habit of turning face on Nitro and back to heel on Thunder. Don't ask us, it's WCW. The Latino World Order, the LWO. A frustrated, coffee-stained Eddie Guerrero formed his own offshoot version of the NWO, which was comprised of the hard-working luchadores ignored every week by Eric Bischoff. They performed heinous acts as well, like standing around while Guerrero cut angry promos, and then standing around some more while Guerrero berated Rey Mysterio Jr. Gripping television. The OWN. The NWO parallel that was run by the faintly Ultimate Warrior, who was hounding Hulk Hogan upon his 1998 return to the spotlight. The group consisted of two members, Warrior and a sexually spellbound disciple, Ed Leslie slash Brutus Beefcake, who was often seen in some random submissive position while Warrior spoke. WWF Raw won a lot in this time frame. NWO Elite. Forged together by the finger poke of doom, which made WCW look like a stuck-in-the-mud, idealist self-parody. Hollywood Hogan reigned again as WCW champion and fearless leader after a fake retirement, aligning with Hall, Nash, Luger, Scott Steiner, and everyone vaguely interesting from the Wolfpack and Hollywood, to the delight of few. NWO Black and White. Whomever wasn't absorbed into Elite was left to kick around in this fearsome squadron. Stevie Ray would be the odor-eater-wielding kingpin of such luminaries as Vincent, Brian Adams, Scott Norton, and Horace Hogan. The group had no purpose except to provide fodder for a series of hilarious satires on the old ScoopThis.com website. NWO 2000. Vince Russo was now in charge of a dying WCW and decided to make the NWO his centerpiece heel group since the corporation had worked in WWF. That's a joke, by the way. Bret Hart turned heel to lead the charge of the Outsiders, Steiner, and Jeff Jarrett. The idea was that Goldberg would be the new Stone Cold and combat them, but injuries ruined everything. NWO, the WWE version. After Vince McMahon had botched the WCW/ECW invasion, he needed another popular concept to ruin. In early 2002, McMahon hired Hogan, Hall, and Nash to run a hostile takeover of his increasingly stale WWF shows. By this point, the cool factor was gone, as evidenced by the t-shirts for the Guerrilla Warriors bearing a highly visible WWF logo. The following week, the ratings battle was even closer, with Nitro doing a 4.61 to Raw's 4.43. Head-to-head, both shows did an 8.99 combined rating, a brand new record, in the segment in which Austin, as WWF champion, came out on Raw to confront Vince McMahon at a 5.6, another new record. In the same quarter, Nitro did a 3.9. In fact, of all the quarters, Raw won 4, Nitro won 3, and 1 was basically a tie. Bischoff was sweating. And then, the next week, everything hit the fan. For the first time since May 27, 1996, Raw beat Nitro in the head-to-head ratings battle, ending an epic 83-week winning streak. Raw, built for 2 hours around a supposed McMahon vs. Austin singles match that never ended up taking place, drew a 4.63 to Nitro's 4.34. The final few minutes also did a 6.0 quarter, the highest in history for Raw. Bischoff went nuclear. Frustrated beyond belief, he was looking to take his anger out on someone. And that someone wound up being Ric Flair, the man fans identified with WCW more than any other. Flair, who hadn't been used on TV for months, missed the Thunder event on April 9 in which he was supposed to reform the Four Horsemen. He claimed that he'd given the company plenty of advance notice that he was going to attend his son Reed's AAU Freestyle Wrestling Championships at the Pontiac Silverdome that same day. Unfortunately, advance notice was useless in WCW because the shows were often booked literally at the last minute. The term literally is not being used facetiously. There were times when the shows were still being written while they were on the air live. Flair never knew he was supposed to be at Thunder until 3 days before the show, at which point he wasn't about to change his plans. Lesson not learned. Despite having a full-blown writing staff headed by no less than Stephanie McMahon-Levesque, there have been times recently where Raw was also being written as the show was on the air. Actually, written is not correct. The show is generally written several days in advance and then given to Vince McMahon to give it final approval. Often, approval is not given and rewrites are ordered. And then rewrites of the rewrites are ordered. And then rewrites of those rewrites are ordered. Is it any wonder the average tenure of a new WWE writer is about 6 weeks? Bischoff came completely unglued, verbally tearing Flair apart in a backstage meeting at Nitro on April 13th, which ironically had been deemed Ric Flair Day by the city of Minneapolis, then filed a $2 million lawsuit against him for, quote, playing havoc with the script of the wildly popular productions and, quote, disrupting WCW's ability to introduce its planned storyline, causing significant loss of time, money, and effort by WCW. On the bright side, Reed won first place in his division. The big pay-per-view of the month was Spring Stampede, which was one of those rare cards that looked horrific on paper, but ended up being, perhaps because expectations were so low, pretty dang good. Both Raven vs. Dallas Page for the U.S. title and Chavo Guerrero vs. Ultimo Dragon were excellent. The main event saw Sting lose the WCW title to Randy Savage, who became the very epitome of a transitional champion when he dropped the belt to Hogan the following evening on Nitro. Savage was not the only transitional champion, as Raven, who won the U.S. title from Page in their match, immediately dropped the belt the following night to Goldberg, who was starting to catch fire not only as a ratings draw, but as a merchandise seller. In many ways, Goldberg was WCW's greatest ace in the hole, and in hindsight, was their last best chance at salvaging the company. His segments on Nitro were becoming the most highly rated, and his merchandise sales were beginning to skyrocket as well. It appeared that they truly had a fresh, hot commodity that fans were willing to pay to see. In their efforts to push Goldberg to the moon, however, WCW made some critical mistakes. Ever since the announcers had mentioned that he was 60-0, fans with way too much spare time had begun to keep track of his winning streak. These fans were so hardcore that they even kept track of his untelevised house show wins. It was fun to see fans so interested in a character, especially one that WCW had created from the ground up. Of course, since WCW created it, they also had to kill it. 1 week, announcer Schiavone's number didn't jive with the number the hardcores had. Then, the next week, it was even further off. As it turned out, in a lame effort to make his streak appear more meaningful, the company started to add imaginary numbers to the total. This had the exact opposite of its intended effect, as once fans figured out that the streak number had become fiction, all those signs fans had been bringing to the arenas, trumpeting Goldberg's record, disappeared. Worse yet, WCW was so happy to hear fans chanting Goldberg's name that they decided to pipe in some fake Goldberg chants to make it seem like the fans were making even more noise. For whatever reason, though, the Nitro TV directors apparently weren't clued into this, because soon, shots began to appear of the crowd sitting there with their mouths closed amidst loud Goldberg chants. Again, once the fans figured out the chants were being piped in, they stopped chanting so much. Nitro the following week was in Norfolk, Virginia, at the Scope, just a half hour away from Raw, which was running in Hampton. Unfortunately, Nitro was bumped to a horrible post-midnight time slot, so Raw not only broke another ratings record, but broke it by a full point, 5.71, to become the most watched wrestling show in the history of cable. The most memorable part of the show was a series of DX vignettes where they actually went to the Scope before Nitro started and, quote, invaded. Their invasion, which should have been seen as an omen of sorts for the future WCW invasion of the WWF, consisted of them asking fans if they thought WCW sucked and banging on the outside doors trying to get in. There was one great line where Waltman screamed that he wanted Bischoff to come out and tell him to his face why he was fired. It was that kind of renegade, in-your-face incident that most fans found hilarious. Plus, it was real, and if fans believed one thing about the fake business of pro wrestling, it was that WWF and WCW really hated each other. There was no traditional burial of Ric Flair this week, because Flair was still being sued for $2 million for his fatherly behavior weeks earlier. There were many who thought this whole thing was a work, despite the various signs pointing to it being a stark reality, including settlement talks which don't happen in fake lawsuits. Fans on the internet were outraged. WCW's website actually took advantage of this by posting the following ad in late May. Quote, Ric Flair merchandise now on sale in the Pro Shop. Get it before it runs out. The WCW Pro Shop now features selected Ric Flair merchandise at a reduced price. Internet fans, don't read anything into this. But they did. There were fans who tried to organize Nitro boycotts, which never worked. Fans who tried to start letter-writing campaigns, which never worked. And fans who voted for Flair online in the People magazine's 50 Most Beautiful People in the World poll. Shockingly, that one actually did work, and Flair came in second only to Hank the Angry Drunken Dwarf from Howard Stern with 17,145 votes. What was more impressive was that Hank was actually among the available choices while Flair was a write-in candidate. WCW had a problem at the Augusta, Georgia house show on April 30th. The main event was scheduled to be Flair versus Hennig, but with Flair out indefinitely and Hennig, well, just not there, fans were very upset. So upset, in fact, that hundreds of them demanded refunds. After thinking over several scenarios, the decision was made to do a last-minute change and have Chris Benoit beat Booker T to win the TV title. It worked! The fans were overjoyed. So the decision was made to do it again the next night. And then again, and again, and again. The belt changed hands 4 times in 4 days at the house shows, going from Booker to Benoit to Booker to Benoit to Booker again. Every night, the fans went crazy as they watched something special happen right there in their hometown. But then on Monday, when Booker T showed up to lose the belt to Fit Finlay on TV, the announcers never mentioned anything about the house show title changes. They just ignored them. And to all the casual fans watching around the nation, it was as though nothing had ever happened. It also sent a very strong message to all those previously overjoyed fans in Norfolk, Greenville, North Charleston, and Savannah. You don't count. And if anything happens in your little hick town, it won't be acknowledged on TV because it's not important. If they hadn't already done enough to kill business in those areas, this was another nail in the coffin. May was the beginning of WCW's house show tour from hell. They booked 31, yes, 31 house shows during the month. Because the company was still on fire and the previously mentioned mistakes had not caught up with them yet, this was possible. To make life easier for everyone, they split the crew in half so nobody would have to work every single show. Guys still weren't happy, though, as the once very easy road schedule of WCW was now a complete nightmare. But Bischoff wasn't really concerned about any of these small issues. He was still too obsessed with conquering the WWF in the weekly ratings war. By this point, word of Bischoff's alleged increasing mental instability had reached Vince McMahon, who decided to have some fun by doing everything in his power to drive Eric completely over the edge. He had his hooligan group DX invade the Norfolk Scope, where Nitro was being presented. Of course, the WWF guys couldn't get into the arena, so the invasion merely consisted of them talking to fans and telling WCW to suck it. A week or so later, the WWF sent DX and a film crew to Smyrna, Georgia for another invasion, this time of WCW headquarters. Unfortunately, WCW headquarters were private property, so Nick Lambrose called the cops and actually claimed that 25 guys were attacking their offices. Cops showed up and told DX to hit the bricks. Their next stop was CNN Center, where they claimed they wanted to interview Ted Turner. The problem here was that the camera crew was now terrified and wouldn't film anything except them standing around in the lobby doing crotch chops and chatting with fans. This was even lamer than the previous invasion, but once again, fans wanted reality, and that's what they were getting. That evening on Nitro, Bischoff hit the ring to reveal his master plan for revenge. It was ingenious in that mad scientist losing his mind sort of way. He entered the ring, literally shaking with rage, and recited a speech that he had given many times in the past, almost word for word, to folks backstage. "Vince McMahon, this is for you. I'm coming to your backyard this Sunday. That's right, Worcester, Massachusetts. Got a little pay-per-view thing going on, and I've got a hell of an idea, just a hell of an idea. You want me? I'm going to be in your backyard. Consider this an open invitation, Vince McMahon. You show up at Slamboree, it'll be you and me in the ring. How about it, Vinny? But I want to warn you people right now, if you think Vince McMahon has got the guts to show up, don't buy this pay-per-view, because I guarantee you he's not man enough to step into the ring with me. But I'll be there, Vinnie Mac. I'll be waiting for you, and I'm going to knock you out. See you there." The fans in attendance, understanding the reality of the challenge, cheered Eric as a babyface. The WWF's response on Raw 2 hours later was to have announcers Jim Ross and Jim Cornette cry about it, and to have Waltman come out and tell Eric to suck it. A few days later, on WWF.com, Vince issued a statement calling Eric's move a cheap ploy to increase pay-per-view buys. Therefore, he wrote, "I will not appear at Turner's next pay-per-view as invited. However, if Mr. Bischoff is hell-bent on fighting me, then such a fight can be arranged at any time, in any parking lot in the country, void of television cameras, photographers, and public announcement." Eric wasn't finished. That Thursday on Thunder, he cut not one, but two promos challenging Vince. He also read a real-life legal letter that Vince's attorney, the famed and terrifying Jerry McDevitt, had sent to him, threatening him for what it claimed was a cheap bait-and-switch to try to get fans to order the pay-per-view. In a true story, McDevitt claimed that when Bischoff told the fans that the match wasn't going to take place, he was actually insinuating that it was. Because in wrestling, when a person says something isn't going to happen, it's usually a sign that it is. Sadly, this never went to court. It would have been very interesting to see a judge and jury's reaction to that statement. They also aired a Bischoff training video on Thunder, which was comical because he was really training quite hard for an imaginary fight. And imaginary it was, to seemingly everyone, save for Bischoff and Hogan. Bischoff noted in his autobiography, Controversy Creates Cash, that Hogan had convinced him that Vince would definitely be there, quote, "to kick your ass." "I fully expected Vince to show up," Eric wrote. "We had security waiting at all the exits. I was fully prepared to get my ass kicked. I didn't think I would. My kickboxing skills were still there, and I thought I could work the ring." Yes, this is what the man in charge of WCW was doing at the time. Honing his martial arts skills for a match that was never, ever going to take place. Bischoff came to the ring at Slamboree and had Michael Buffer introduce Vince. Of course, there was no Vince. So Bischoff had the referee count the imaginary Vince out and award him the match. The deal had more than run its course, so it came off as incredibly stupid. The only other major angle of note at Slamboree saw Hall turn on Nash and cost them the tag team titles to Sting and Giant. Neither wanted to do the turn, but Eric insisted, so they half-heartedly went along with it. It ended up being the usual WCW brilliance, as Hall immediately left to attend rehab for 6 weeks, which was known well in advance, so they could have changed booking plans, and then Nash never did one interview acknowledging the situation. Ric Flair, meanwhile, had gotten himself into great shape, sitting at home doing nothing, and wanted to work somewhere. However, because of his treatment, that somewhere was not WCW. He filed a countersuit that he hoped would get him out of his deal and allow him to go back to the WWF for a top heel run against Austin. Bischoff, aware of this, made it known that if he wanted to come back, he'd drop the lawsuit and forget the whole thing ever happened. Flair's attorney said they could talk about it, but he had a list of contract restructuring demands a mile long. So the man who just months earlier was the biggest ratings draw in either company remained on the sidelines instead of helping WCW. Lesson not learned. You'd think that following the disaster that was the entire Eric Bischoff-Vince McMahon non-match, the days of publicly making challenges that would never be accepted would be over. Think again. In 2006, following yet another D-Generation X reunion of Shawn Michaels and Triple H, Road Dogg Jesse James and Billy Gunn decided to challenge their old partners. Sadly for the latter duo, they now competed in TNA Wrestling and had changed their name to the Voodoo Kin Mafia, which may have been the stupidest name for a tag team ever. But wait, they did so because abbreviated it became VKM, the same initials as Vincent Kennedy McMahon. How clever. For weeks, the pair came out on national television, bad-mouthing Michael Hickenbottom and Paul Levesque, Sean and Hunter's real names, just so you knew it was a shoot, offering to fight them anytime, anywhere. They even went to WWE house shows attempting to get attention. Their challenges, of course, were completely ignored. In an effort to elicit some kind of reaction, they offered $1 million to their WWE foes for a fight. Again, ignored. They told Sean to fight them at the Alamo, really, and showed up there, really. Ignored. Finally, the TNA guys just claimed victory. During said promo, in which they noted how much they hated their WWE rivals and how Sean and Hunter were cowards, they got serious and told Paul they legitimately hoped his torn quadriceps would get better soon. You know, because all that other stuff was fake. Amazingly, all these words and actions did not keep both men from returning to WWE in 2013 and even getting a run with the WWE tag team title. Wrestling, everyone. Wrestling. Just weeks after the whole childish Vince McMahon versus Eric Bischoff program took place, WCW took their complaints a step further by filing an unfair business practices countersuit against the WWF, a suit almost identical to the one the WWF had filed against them in 1996 after Hall and Nash jumped ship. The suit, like that of the WWF, was mostly frivolous, claiming that Vince and his crew had done mean things, like saying all their wrestlers were old, and this was hilarious because on several occasions when announcer Jim Ross made such claims, elderly men like Gerald Briscoe, Pat Patterson, and Vince himself were involved in matches as he spoke. They did have one good point, however, that the WWF had falsely claimed on several occasions that WCW was giving away free tickets when, in reality, the shows in question were legitimately sold out. When DX invaded the scope, the WWF even went so far as to digitally insert a graphic on the marquee claiming that tickets to the show were still available. Yes, they went to these absurd lengths for a corny skit. In the professional wrestling business, the suit read, "The giving away of free tickets to an event on the day of the show is a response to a failure to sell out to the venue, and it reflects badly on a promotion, suggesting that an insufficient number of fans were willing to pay to see the show." Coincidentally, on Nitro that evening, Schiavone claimed the Raw show in Hampton was not sold out when, in fact, it was. At the time of the latest WCW-WWF lawsuit, the company found itself being sued by one of its workers as well. In June, prelim wrestler Bobby Walker filed a lawsuit against the company, claiming racial discrimination, saying WCW told him point blank that he was being hired as a token black man and that he always had to lose. Never mind the fact that there were 10 times the number of white guys who were asked to always lose by WCW. Another one of his points was that he made a lot less than many of the white performers, including, he actually said this, Ric Flair. The suit was eventually thrown out. As absurd as this whole thing sounds on the surface, another suit filed by Sonny Ono dragged on for 5 years, and numerous minority wrestlers jumped on the bandwagon. When Ono's suit was finally settled by Time Warner, long after WCW had ceased to exist, it was said that the guys filing suit, quote, made out like bandits. In the midst of all the lawsuits and childish behavior, WCW signed 3 big names. Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone would help generate mainstream interest, and the artist formerly known as the Ultimate Warrior would help to launch them into another universe. Rodman was a friend of Hogan's, and Dallas Page was in tight with Karl Malone. The idea was to bring them in for a match at the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view in July, in an attempt to generate mainstream publicity, hopefully similar to what Mike Tyson's appearance at WrestleMania had done for the WWF. It worked better than anyone had likely imagined. Rodman first appeared on the June 8th Nitro after skipping out on a Chicago Bulls practice session without bothering to tell anyone, for which he was subsequently fined $10,000. Keeping with his bad boy persona, he teamed up with Hogan as Rodzilla to put the boots to Page, setting up Page and Malone versus Hogan and Rodman for the pay-per-view. The angle got tons of publicity nationwide, as many of the major sports shows and evening newscasts aired footage of the incident. More Hogan fun was on display on June 14 at the Great American Bash pay-per-view. He teamed with Bret Hart to beat Roddy Piper and Randy Savage in a horrible match, which led immediately to an equally horrible match where Piper, wrestling with 2 fake hips, beat Savage with a figure four. The main event saw Sting beat Giant in a match that was memorable mostly because Giant came out smoking a cigarette to play off an interview Sting did the week before where he yelled at Giant for smoking too much. None of this could even approach the worst match on the show, however, which saw the incredible Juventud Guerrera as part of the big push that he was promised after agreeing to drop his mask, beat Ron Reese. Juve at the time was about 5'5" and 160 pounds, and Reese was a legit 7'2", almost 400 pounds, and best of all, could not wrestle to save his life. Juve's superhero babyface performance consisted of him being destroyed forever, then getting the win with a messed up Hurricane Rana, after Van Hammer clonked Reese with a chair. Juve probably wanted his mask back more than ever at this point, just to hide his shame. By far the lowest moment of the day, however, actually took place backstage when someone with inside knowledge of the Hart family called Bischoff and told him to tell Bret that his father, Stu, had passed away. As it turned out, it was a hoax, but everyone was greatly disturbed by it, and nobody ever found out who made the call. The Bash show was actually not even a focal point for Eric, as his eyes were on the big Nitro coming up the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. By early June, they'd sold over 20,000 tickets and were closing in on a $1 million gate. As the date drew nearer, Hogan, the wily veteran, came up with a plan. Aware that all the Turner bigwigs would be at the show, he offered to take Goldberg on in a non-title, non-televised match, in which Goldberg would get the win and send the folks home happy. All the company execs, seeing the huge house, would obviously assume that Hogan drew it, and his standing as WCW's top dog would be cemented. As the show approached, however, the decision was made to change the Hogan-Goldberg match to a televised title match. This was due almost entirely to the fact that Nitro had been losing the ratings war, and Bischoff was obsessed with beating McMahon, even if only for 1 week. With Hogan taking on Goldberg, there was absolutely no way he could lose the night. Make no mistake about it. July 6th should have been a pivotal day in wrestling history. It was on that day that Bill Goldberg, less than 1 year into his professional career, beat Hulk Hogan clean in the middle of the ring to win the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. Internally, the sense was that this was the beginning of a new era for the company,